On the Commons with me today is Evan McKenzie. Evan is a political science professor at the University of Illinois in Chicago. He's an attorney. He's the author of the definitive book on homeowners associations called Privatopia, Homeowner Associations and the Rise of Residential Private Government. He's the author of many articles and essays, and he's been interviewed extensively both here and abroad. Evan, thank you so much for giving up part of your Saturday to join us right here on the Commons.
Thank you, Sue. It's a pleasure to be here with you.
I've been looking forward to having you on. As you know, you're probably the most, everybody looks up to you and as sort of a leader in this entire area. So, as you know, I only have one phone line, so we can't take phone calls. But I do get I did get a whole lot of emails from people who have a ton of questions for you. We'll get to some of those during the second half. But and there's a lot of questions and there's a lot of anger out there, Evan, and there's a lot of confusion about what people are dealing with here.
Yes, there is.
And maybe one of, we'll get to the questions in the second portion. Maybe we'll start off with one of them, and this is from George in Arizona. He says, would you please ask Evan if another study's in the works? If not, what would it take? A grant? Maybe an investigative reporter along with him? We need an update because the evil empire is beginning to feel our anger and realizes that we won't go away. Another study that includes so many of our complaints, basic in regard to what boards have done and why, to matters of American government and values, still go unanswered. But the question is there going to be a follow-up to Privatopia?
Well, I've written some articles since Privatopia came out. I've written a couple of law review articles and an article in Urban Affairs Review. And I have some other things planned, some other articles planned. I wrote a piece about a really incredible episode in Las Vegas involving a place called Bonanza Village.
Yes.
And I presented that paper at a conference at the University of California at Irvine. And that's going to be published either in a book an edited volume of articles on the phenomenon of gated communities around the world, or if that doesn't happen, then I'll publish it elsewhere. But yeah, I'm still writing on this issue, and I will continue to do that. And I have in mind one possibility is at some point putting out a second edition of Privatopia with chapters at the end that cover some of the recent developments, such as the growth and activities of the homeowners movement and the what I think kind of insidious development here that is taking place between cities and homeowner associations. In other words, where I left off in Privatopia, I was talking about how this was really driven by developers, and that was essentially true at that time. But I really feel that in recent years, in a number of parts of the country, Las Vegas being one of them, the cities are becoming the driving force, and in some cases they're insisting that developers use homeowner associations even if they don't want to, because they've bought into this way of doing things.
Mm-hmm.
It's really become a form of privatization.
It has.
And so I think those developments need to be talked about and in some detail. And another thing that I'd like to explore is the whole gated community phenomenon, which has a lot of somewhat disturbing aspects to it. So either I'll write another book about it, or I will revise Privatopia and in the second edition keep what's in there but add some things to it. I'm writing a book right now that's about something different, and that one I hope to finish by the end of by maybe May or June. And after that, we'll see where we go for there. But in the meantime, I'm still writing articles on it.
But you're still very interested in this phenomenon, in the movement, or in what's happening, the privatization of local governments.
Oh, I'm very interested in it. I think this is an incredibly important topic. It relates to so many different things, because homeowner associations and common interest housing developments are one example, one very important example, of a larger phenomenon, and that is really... it's a little bit hard to characterize, but government is being carried out increasingly, not by big public governments like the city of Chicago or the county of, or say, Orange County in California. I mean, those governments still exist, but they've delegated large parts of their functions over particular parts of their jurisdiction to all kinds of special districts. And homeowner associations, in a way, are like a kind of special district. So you have all kinds of things like tax increment financing or TIF districts and business improvement districts and special improvement districts and all these little port authority districts and on and on and on. So what you have here now is a sort of a metropolis that is carved up into zillions of little special purpose districts. Now, there may be some good things about that. Maybe there are some efficiency gains. I don't know. It's possible. That's the argument that's made in favor of this, that it's efficient to do things this way. But more and more aspects of urban governance are really placed outside popular control by these this endless proliferation of special districts. And the visibility of the activities of local government goes way down. Because nobody, if you know, if your city council passes a law about mosquito abatement, you might know about it. But if it's parceled out to some little mosquito abatement district, like we have here in Chicago, they can make any decision they want, and the newspapers don't cover it. Nobody knows where the meetings are. Nobody hears a thing about it. And half the time, the people who run these districts are not even elected. They're appointed. And more and more and more of our resources are being controlled by all these little tiny special districts, and often enormous amounts of money. In the case of homeowner associations, we know they're controlling tens of billions of dollars.
I think the numbers are $34 billion annually.
Yes. It was $20 billion some years ago when I was writing. It's more now.
Yeah, I think I read the latest figure, estimate I read was somewhere in the neighborhood of $34 billion. So it's something that people aren't going to give up very easily. But you're right in that a lot of local municipalities are mandating associations. I know Fairfax County has a de facto mandate. And Loudoun County, which is the second fastest growing area in the country right after Las Vegas, has an actual mandate. But this is a way for the local governments to collect the taxes, but at the same time distance themselves from their constituents. Because every time you go to them, there's this, you know, hands-off approach. Oh, by the way, go deal with it with your homeowners association. That's private. We don't want to get involved.
Yes. Yes, what they do here is they've set up an arrangement whereby they get a tremendous increase in property tax revenues because these developments involve land that before the homeowner association run development comes in, there's nothing on it. It's just agricultural land or mm-hmm. or some big empty lot or something of this sort. In some cases with urban infill developments, it might be a public housing project like here in Chicago, Cabrini Green,
mm-hmm.
This notorious, horrible housing project that generates no tax revenue is now being turned into a common interest development run community. And so the city, the net revenues to the city or the county are just enormous. And so to make the deal even sweeter with homeowner associations, the people who move into those developments not only have to pay those property taxes, but they also have to pay for their own utilities. In some cases, they're paying to have the streets plowed
mm-hmm.
and the streets lit
mm-hmm.
and the leaves picked up and the trash collected. Every kind of municipal service is privatized. So then the cost of constructing all the infrastructure is added to the cost of the houses. That jacks up the price of new housing for everybody.
But this was supposed to be affordable housing, Evan.
Yeah, but it's not going to. But it becomes very much less affordable this way because the city isn't going to build any infrastructure. They hand all that off to the residents, essentially. And then the services, the maintenance of the infrastructure and all kinds of municipal services, that becomes a pay-as-you-go fee again passed on to the residents. And the city says, thank you very much for your tax revenues. Then you call and ask them for something, and they say, go see your homeowner association.
Exactly.
And this is why, and the cities have caught on to this, and the counties have caught on to this, especially in the rapidly growing parts of the country,
mm-hmm.
Where this has become virtually the sort of default way of doing things now. And nobody wants to think past the bottom line here. They still are not clearly thinking about the political and social and economic consequences of doing what they're doing. But they're coming. There will come a time when they are going to recognize what they have done.
You think they will recognize? I mean, I think we're on a collision course with financial disaster. I mean, personally, that's my gloomy outlook on all of this. But beyond all that, Evan, there's another thing that's happening here. Homeowners are being taxed, if you will, and they're paying for programs now to teach them their duties to a homeowners association. And this is, we're starting to see this crop up in different parts of the country. You know, Nevada's got its ombudsman, or the initial ombudsman's been replaced by someone who now sees it as his responsibility and duty to teach homeowners how to live in an association. Same
yeah.
thing's happening here in Virginia. In California, they want to rewrite Davis-Sterling, and whatever they put in place of Davis-Sterling, they think should encompass everything, whether there's a mandatory association with common property there or not, but they feel everybody ought to pay into a fund.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Well, some people, Noam Chomsky is this linguist, teaches linguistics at MIT, and he's a big political radical, but he uses the term the manufacturer of consent. Actually, that term doesn't come from Chomsky. It was Walter Lippmann
mm-hmm.
back in the 1920s who said this originally. But it's the manufacturer of consent. So since people, the problem now, the industry and others are realizing is that a lot of people are not consenting to be governed this way. So now the new idea is, well, we'll manufacture that consent. We will educate them.
Mm-hmm.
And I assume the next step is that as a benevolent way of enforcing the rules, if you violate the rules, maybe they'll just send you off to a re-education center.
is that
too far-fetched? They'll take you off. You know, what you need here is you pay your fine, and then we'll send you off and have you re-educated. Part of your fine is three education sessions to learn responsibilities.
They've taken it a step beyond that, Evan. They're foreclosing.
Yes. Well, that's already happening.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, Houston, we're going to see something coming out of Houston pretty soon, and the numbers are going to be absolutely devastating. But there are a lot of people who are losing their homes. What a nifty, easy way to get rid of someone you don't particularly want in the neighborhood. I mean, aren't exclusionary documents outlawed now? They've been declared unconstitutional, but we've given them another vehicle, another way of saying, oh, well, let's see, you've got grass clipping, you're mowing your lawn, and you've got grass clippings on the sidewalk, therefore we're going to fine you, and then we're going to sell your house on the courthouse steps, and we're going to move you out of here. We don't need people like you around.
Mm-hmm.
But that's happening.
Well, it doesn't. That would not surprise me at all. I don't have data on exactly who's getting foreclosed on. I know the number of foreclosures is enormous.
It is enormous.
And if we are going to have difficult economic times, probably, sadly, that will increase. But you know what really troubles me. See, I can understand why it is necessary to collect assessments to support an
mm-hmm.
association. If you live in a place that has this type of government, and you have to pay for certain things, then obviously people have to pay their assessments. But what has happened here, unfortunately, is that boards are just contracting out to these lawyers, collections lawyers, basically,
mm-hmm.
The ability to make all the decisions about how to do that. That's the problem.
Yes.
I mean, it's one thing to say we need to collect our assessments. Yes, you do.
Mm-hmm.
But the board has other responsibilities. And if the board makes the decision about how to collect the assessments, which is what they should be doing, then the board will balance that with their other needs, such as maintaining some sense of community and cohesion in the entire development, and not just nailing people to the wall and driving them out of their community and engaging in what I would call sharp practices. I mean, a sane board of directors would not want to do that. But what they're doing is, because as volunteers, they don't want the responsibility, I assume, in most cases, they just contract the whole thing out to a law firm. And the law firm, as you know, will say, well, that's okay, we won't charge you anything for this. We're going to collect all our fees from the people who didn't pay, or the people who broke the rules. We'll collect all our fees from them. And then they really go after them. And then people lose their homes not because of the assessments. That's the whole justification for this, is the association needs the assessments. But you can try to pay the assessments and you'll still have a lien on your house because you have to pay the attorney's fees first. So it becomes really a matter of attorney's fees.
You've raised so many points here. One thing I want to touch on, which is one of my favorite bugaboos, is the fact that so many of these collection agencies are refusing to accept checks. They're returning them.
Really?
Yes. That seems to be a big problem. I hear from people across the country saying, you know, I've been sending in my payments and the collection agency, the attorney, whoever it happens to be, is sending it back. I call the Federal Trade Commission and ask them if in conjunction with the Fair Debt Collections Practices Act there was any requirement for associations to collect or to cash these checks. And they said, no, there's no law that says you have to accept payments.
Well, what do they want instead of a check?
They don't want anything. You know, they
just want the house.
They just, whatever it is they want, they're just making it incredibly difficult. And that's happening a lot around the country. As I said, I've heard from a lot of people about it, and it just increases the amount they owe. And it increases the fines, it increases the late fees, it increases all sorts of things. And quite often, you say we need to pay, and I agree with you, by the way, if you live in something like this that depends on collecting assessments from homeowners to pay for the services that we're supposed to be paying for, then why are we turning away money?
Well, yeah, exactly. I think the whole justification for this is the survival of the association, but increasingly it becomes a matter of the survival of the attorneys and the other professionals who make a living off these associations.
And I
think, you know, I've been very critical of the industry over the years because they have not policed themselves and they have bitterly resisted letting any level of government police these professionals.
Yeah.
And you have to have one or the other.
You have to have something.
And I really feel that the industry has to either have to have very meaningful self-regulation, which would be subject to some kind of scrutiny from outside so we can see what they're doing, or there has to be state regulation of these professionals.
Exactly.
And I think that's the only way to go. I think that this has to be a government responsibility to make sure that these professionals are not gouging people. Because right now, the lawyers who practice in this field, in many cases, are just shooting fish in a barrel.
Mm-hmm.
The individual owner can't even get an attorney.
Mm-hmm.
Because virtually everybody who practices law in this area on a regular basis, and therefore, meaning just about everybody who knows anything about this specialized area,
right,
will only represent associations. They won't represent owners.
But wouldn't it be a conflict of interest, Evan, for them to represent owners as well?
Not unless it involved one of their former clients.
How can you walk into a courtroom? I mean, this is what my thinking is. How can you walk into a courtroom one day and say, you know, here's my client, the association has every right in the world to fine a homeowner, and then walk in the next day with a little homeowner saying, you know, my client here is being fined to death, and you know it's an unconstitutional delegation of sovereign power, and therefore associations shouldn't have the authority to fine. I mean, you can't argue, you lose credibility. It would seem to me you either firmly believe that you can do something, or you firmly believe that it's an absolutely disgusting practice, and you don't want to have anything to do with it.
Well, let me give you a different perspective on that.
Okay.
Based upon the way American lawyers practice law, that's the way things go. We have a legal profession that is sharply divided, for example, between criminal prosecutors and criminal defense attorneys, and never the twain shall meet.
Mm-hmm.
In personal injury law, we have PI plaintiff lawyers who represent the injured party, and then we have defense attorneys who represent insurance companies, and they have nothing to do with each other. And I could go on and on and on. We have creditors lawyers and debtors lawyers in bankruptcy.
Mm-hmm.
Now that, in fact, that's the way things typically are organized here. And by the way, in the case of homeowner associations, what we have is lawyers who specialize in representing associations and no lawyers who represent owners. That's the actual situation. We don't even have another side.
Yeah, that's true.
But here's what lawyers are supposed to be able to do. Lawyers are supposed to be professional advocates whose job it is to represent clients, not entire social interests. They are not supposed to be in hoc to some industry.
Mm-hmm.
They are supposed to be advocates for positions. And in England, they still can do this. In England, you might be, I mean, theoretically, you'd be prosecuting one day, defending the next.
Mm-hmm.
And ideally, lawyers would be able to represent the owner one day and present his or her point of view, and then on another day represent an association. Now, not the same one, because the conflict of interest arises from representing particular clients. But what I'm really criticizing here, in a way, is the way our legal profession is organized, and particularly as that impacts this particular field. Because every single practical, I think it's almost literally true, there are virtually no attorneys in the entire United States of America who specialize in representing the owners.
Yeah.
There aren't any.
No, I agree with you.
And so we have the whole legal profession, essentially, to the extent that it cares about this issue, is on the side of the associations.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that is a tremendous distortion.
Mm-hmm.
And then when they set up a law revision commission, you have a whole lot of representatives of one side of the argument, which is, by the way, a side that they have a right to present.
Mm-hmm.
But the problem is there's nobody representing the other side.
Exactly.
The only other side, to the extent that anyone speaks up for consumers or owners, it would be, well, you hope that you get a law professor in there who has an even-handed view of it and isn't a former president of the Community Associations Institute or something.
Every time in my experience dealing with homeowners and people who are having problems, and from what I've been led to believe, every time there's one attorney who represents a homeowner, often pro bono, and then goes on, then is inundated with calls from other homeowners,
right?
Because finally there's someone there who's actually stepped out from the shadows and said, all right, you know, let's put an end to some of this nonsense. What I'm hearing now is that industry attorneys are going in and threatening them and saying, if you don't quit representing, especially if they win, if you don't quit representing homeowners, we're going to tie you up in so much paperwork that you will never have time to take care of your other clients, who probably are better payers, you know, have more money to pay.
Yeah, I don't know. I know that I can't confirm that one way or the other.
No, I can't either.
But I do know that it is a common practice with, let's say, small personal injury firms.
Mm-hmm.
That when they're up against an insurance company in a high stakes case,
mm-hmm.
that the insurance company's lawyers will try to do that. They will simply try to put them out of business. They'll say, you're going to spend so much time on this case that you're never going to be able to do another one.
Oh, really?
Yeah, and it happens. It's a major problem, but it's not against the rules to litigate as hard as you can. See. It's not against the rules to do things like that, as far as I know. I mean, up to a point. The problem, though, is that somehow when you have millions and millions of people out here, individuals, who need something. They need to be represented in the public policy process. They need to be represented before the courts. And they can't find a way to make their voice heard. And this is the core problem here is something. There's an economist named Mansur Olson, and he talked about this exact issue many, many years ago with respect to consumers in general. He wasn't speaking of homeowner associations. The book is called The Logic of Collective Action. It's an economics classic. He called this, what we have here, a collective action problem. He said, when you compare producer interests and consumer interests, There's always going to be an imbalance. And he was criticizing people who always say, oh, don't worry, you know, if you've got these consumers out there and there's any demand for, and they have any need for anything, any demand for anything, suddenly people will serve that demand. So supply and demand will take care of everything. And he said, no, it won't. Here's why it won't. Because you have a particular kind of a problem here. Everybody's interest in the consumer side is relatively small. The collective interest is enormous. It's staggering. It's billions and billions and billions of dollars worth of real estate. Phenomenal.
Mm-hmm.
Might even be a trillion for all I know. It's an enormous amount of mortgage debt and equity that owners represent here. But it's comprised of millions of smaller interests. Now, people have to evaluate for themselves What is the benefit to me of engaging in collective action, of joining an interest group, of forming an interest group, of calling people on the phone and lobbying? And they have to think, what am I going to get out of that? Versus what do I have to put into it? Now, if you're a consumer and you do that calculation, individually, 99% of those consumers are going to say it's not worth it for me to do any collective action.
Mm-hmm.
But switch over to the producer side. If you're a lawyer practicing and your whole livelihood comes from this industry, this form of housing, is it worth it for you to get involved with CAI or some other group? Is it worth it? Oh, yeah. Because are the benefits to you going to outweigh whatever cost you put into it? Oh, yes. So narrow producer interests, relatively few people, but intensely interested with a huge financial stake, those people organize. They form interest groups. They form all kinds of groups. They talk to each other all the time. But consumers don't. Consumers don't. And they individually say, well, I just want my problem solved, which is a major issue, because as soon as their problem is solved, they're gone.
Exactly, yeah.
And so they don't form the long-lasting groups that they need to advance their interests, and they are not, and it's weird because they control all this money ultimately through the associations. Ultimately, the owners could control the associations, and they should be controlling them. Ultimately, the producer groups just basically control the associations. And unless the owners want to take back their own associations and intervene in the policy process so that they can restructure the laws and enable themselves to do that and protect their interests, they don't have a prayer. Because as isolated individuals, it's just too, same for the individual lawyer, it's too small an interest. It's too small, you're just not big enough to fight against these organized interests unless you yourself get organized.
I think, well, many people don't, I mean, many people who buy a house don't move in with the idea of getting organized and with the idea of fighting all these things.
They're
told basically, hey, these are going to protect your property values, we're going to, you know, which is basically what I was told 21 years ago, we're going to pick up your trash and remove the snow.
It's going to be hassle-free living.
Exactly.
Right.
Carefree living. It's all there. We're going to take a quick break, and we'll be right back in a couple of minutes. Back by popular demand, one-way ticket to hell.
Well, I finally bought my dream home to enjoy retirement life. I've made new friends and buddies, lots of parties for my wife. It seemed that life was perfect, all my neighbors felt the same. Then along came death by CCRs, life's over, I'm fair game. Those petty rules and regulations, it's enough to make you cry. They're full of woes, no pink flamingos, someone tell us why. Slick managers and lawyers slither close, but they won't tell why our dream home should remind us we bought a one-way ticket to hell.
WEBR, Fairfax Radio, you're on the Commons. I'm Sue Bartholomew, and on the Commons with me is Evan McKenzie. Hi, Evan.
Hi, Sue.
We've got so much to talk about. One of the things that is happening right now is in the wake of the tragedies of last week, is people want to show their patriotism, their unity. They've got some form of demonstration. They want to put up flags. And we're hearing from a whole lot of people that their association will not allow them to fly flags.
Yes.
And that's a big, big issue right now. And we have we have a news release from Arizona. Three legislators have formally asked Arizona homeowners or associations in particular to please drop their prohibitions until they can go in and enact legislation. Jeb Bush, Governor Jeb Bush in Florida has done pretty much the same thing. I found on the California Homeowners Association page yesterday that they're reminding landlords and homeowners associations that in regard to government code section 434.5A, there's an existing law that prohibits homeowners associations from interfering with the homeowner or tenant's legal rights to display an American flag.
Mm-hmm.
I understand, and I haven't seen anything in writing, that Mayor Oscar Goodman of Las Vegas is also weighing in on this. He says this is an absolute outrage. People should be allowed to fly the flag.
Yes. Well, you know, this is one of the most, to me, one of the most outrageous examples of what's wrong with homeowner association governance. This whole question of flags and also political signs, because associations routinely all across the country tell people they can't put up political signs. You can't put up a sign of George Bush for president, Al Gore for president, or whatever, on your own lawn or in your own the window of your own house, your own condo, your own townhouse. I think this is just, not only is it insane, because these signs could and flags could not possibly be viewed as damaging to property values. That is a completely insane idea. And of course there's no truth. It's ludicrous. To even there's no conceivable rationale for it. But it just underlines the deeper problem that these associations are operating outside the framework of the United States Constitution and the Bill of Rights.
Yes.
And it's not just the flag. I mean, this needs to be highlighted. It's not just that we need an exception to put the flag. We need to understand that the exception here is we've got millions of people who are having their basic constitutional rights stripped away from them on the most, the flimsiest, most bogus of excuses by people who just can't stand to look around the neighborhood and see that one house looks different from another because one has a flag and the other one doesn't. They want this fascist uniformity all across the entire community. And the notion that individual people in their homes in the United States of America have to worry about these neighborhood condo Nazis on a day-to-day basis is so profoundly un-American. It is just one of the most unbelievable outrages I've ever heard of. And thank goodness, finally, the American Civil Liberties Union is beginning to take an interest in this issue.
I agree with you.
Yeah, the Twin Rivers case in New Jersey, in which I'm going to be an expert witness. This is it is high time that we recognize what has happened to American civil liberties because of the rise of private government. That's what these things are. They're private governments. And if people don't have the most basic civil liberties in their home, and it's all given away because of some phony baloney contract that they couldn't even negotiate, if that's all it takes for us to lose our civil liberties, then we are doomed. We are doomed. Because if all you need to do is impose a contractual agreement on somebody that comes down from some big corporation and their civil liberties are gone, we're all in trouble. We're all in big trouble. So this needs to be highlighted. There need to be people need to write to their newspapers. They need to call the TV stations. They need to focus a spotlight on these activities in their own areas, wherever it happens, because this is an absolute outrage.
Can I, next week we're going to have a Senator Susan Gerard from Arizona, who's one of the legislators who's put out this press release, and she's planning on introducing legislation in the next legislative session. So we're going to be talking about this issue in particular next week. Everybody join in. But I've got several letters. I've got so much I can tell you about this. I was talking to a writer who said that she'd been contacted or had been talking to 55, she talked to 55 homeowners who were having problems with their associations. 48 of them were being harassed for flying the flag.
Yeah.
Some of them, none of them would go on the record. They were afraid. Some of them were being fined. Mm-hmm. They were afraid of losing their homes. I mean, what have we done to this country? Yesterday when I talked to you, you said that the need for associations or the reason to have an association initially was kind of as a vehicle to provide the funding for cash-strapped municipalities as we sort of grew out of the urban areas and moved into the suburbs. How did we get from providing funding for the necessary services to prohibiting flags?
Yeah, well, you know, my book is in large part about tracing how this peculiar institution evolved. And if you went back 100 years, you'd find that it was basically just, you know, rich people who lived this way.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, I can accept the argument that if a bunch of wealthy people want to get together and go live in Bel Air or someplace, and they want to have a bunch of deed restrictions on their land,
absolutely,
and they agree, and they all know what they're getting into, and they sit down and say, with their lawyers, and they negotiate the agreements that are satisfactory to them, I have no problem with saying that if they want to agree, to oppress each other and to give up their rights for the sake of security, that they should be able to do it. That's fine. I mean, that's part of a free country, I guess. If you want to go off and do this, fine. But that's not what's happening here.
No, it isn't.
What has happened here is that large institutions, first large-scale the real estate development industry, and now more insidiously, cities and counties, have basically decided that this is the way we're all going to live. If you buy if in the rapidly growing parts of the country, this is the way you're going to live,
yep.
Like it or not. So it basically makes a mockery of this entire justification that it's a contract, that you're bound by the terms of a contract. The reason a contract is binding is because you consented to it. But what we're talking about here are contracts that nobody can even negotiate. You can't negotiate one line of your homeowner association CCNRs, not one line. And the reason is because it was all written and recorded against your lot before the houses were built. Before, when this was just a gleam in the eye of some developer. All those things are recorded. It's all take it or leave it. And that type of thing, contracts like that, with some other characteristics as well, are called adhesion contracts.
Mm-hmm.
And basically, it's a take it or leave it contract drawn up by somebody who has all the power
mm-hmm.
and imposed on the person who doesn't have any power.
Mm-hmm.
And that makes a mockery of the whole logic of contract law. Because contract law, the only reason contracts are binding, again, is because you agree to it. And if you don't really know what you're agreeing to, and you don't have much choice in the matter,
and
you can't negotiate, then where's the rationale for holding people to the terms? But this is what we're doing. And cities are, and now we end up with these wacko restrictions that are sort of one size fits all, put together by generation after generation of corporate lawyers. They get, the restrictions get bigger and thicker and more repressive every day. And now they're trying to write in all sorts of things about how you can't sue the developer for construction defects. And the developer, like in the case of Celebration in Florida, the developer basically, in this case Disney, basically retains a veto power over everything the association does forever. And things like this. Now, these clauses like this really, in my view, go beyond anything that was ever intended in the law of restrictive covenants. This is government by contract, government by restrictive covenant. And that has got to be a public policy issue. This whole logic of contract goes out the window when it's about governance. At some point, we have to think about meaningful consent in the governmental arena. We have to talk about consent within the meaning of constitutionalism. Because, in other words, what I'm saying is it should not be possible for a person to be held to a contract that violates their basic constitutional rights. We do not allow, in the enforcement of contracts, race-restrictive covenants that ban the sale of a house to an African-American or an Asian or a Catholic or something of that sort.
Mm-hmm.
Those contracts are null and void, and they have been
mm-hmm.
since 1948.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what needs to happen to these other unconstitutional provisions. Judges should stand up and say, we will not enforce these things. They are against fundamental public policies. They're unconstitutional. And we're not going to allow big institutions to take away individuals' constitutional liberties by contract. We're just not going to allow it to happen. That's what needs to take place.
But what's happening,
if the judges won't do it, the legislatures need to do it.
But what's happening is the judges are saying, oops, it's a contract, and here it is. You agreed. Sorry. Go home, homeowner.
Yes. This is the sad part of it.
Yeah.
Because judge, you know, I went to law school too. I practiced law for 10 years.
Mm-hmm.
I know how judges think. I know how lawyers think. We are taught from the first semester of law school that contracts are sacred.
Mm-hmm.
This is contract is the bedrock fundamental principle of Western law. More fundamental than any other aspect of law is contract. And when you can convince a judge that there is a valid contract,
mm-hmm.
they roll right over.
Mm-hmm.
They roll right over. It's like waving a magic wand or something. They shrink to the size of a pea when they see a contract. And it's really unfortunate because they can't keep genuflecting in the name of contract. They have got to understand that what we have here is government by contract. And when we have government in the American system, we're talking about constitutionalism. And that implies basic liberties. We
but
cannot throw out our basic liberties just because there's a contract in the room.
Well, that's what I agree with you. But what the interpretation seems to be is that when you sign this piece of paper, you agreed to abide by the rules and regulations, and you agreed to give up your constitutional rights.
Mm-hmm.
I start the show quite often with you're now leaving the American zone. You know?
What's that?
I start the show quite often with "You're now leaving the American
yes,
zone."
Yes, I heard that.
And that's essentially, you know, that's essentially what's happening.
But
here.
You see, you know what? When I was a prosecutor for several years, and every time that we took a guilty plea from a defendant, we went through something called a change of plea form. You see, defendants can't just plead guilty. They have to plead guilty making a knowing and intelligent waiver of every single right that they're giving up.
Mm-hmm.
And we'd have to sit here. I must have heard this done a million times. We'd sit there in the courtroom and the judge would say, "Do you understand that by pleading guilty, you're giving up this right
yeah.
and that, the right to a trial, the right to subpoena witnesses, the right to cross-examine those witnesses, and on and on and on and on and on, the right to confront the witnesses against you, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera." And every single question, the defendant would have to say yes, yes, yes. And even that's not enough. They have to put their initials on a form where they initial every single one of these rights that they're giving up and sign it at the bottom. Now, maybe if we're going to go down this road, maybe what needs to happen here is essentially a change of plea form for homeowner associations. Maybe we need a bill of rights that shows what rights you get to keep. And maybe we need a very explicit waiver form that explains in common sense, plain language, exactly what you're giving up. So, for example, in the case of these non-judicial foreclosures where they basically steal your house right out from under you without even taking you to court,
mm-hmm.
maybe that needs to be all spelled out in really simple language so that anyone with an eighth grade education can understand the risk they're taking by going into an association in a state that allows non-judicial foreclosure. Now, if that happened and people said, "Wait a minute, you mean you can take my house away from me without even going to court?" Maybe they wouldn't buy that house.
Yeah, but you know what? Virginia has that. And virtually everything is in an association. Housing, unfortunately, is not a luxury. It's a necessity. And you're either going to get shelter and you're going to move into one of these things or you're going to move under the 14th Street Bridge someplace. And that's the reality of it. In a place like Fairfax County, where you have,
and mm-hmm.
you know, it's funny. We attended. There was a village meeting or a town meeting in another county, and I was invited to attend. And we had a brand new legislator who says, you know, she got into office and she was completely inundated with calls from homeowners, and she was frankly she didn't know what the hell was going on. So she invited me, and I took a friend along who's an attorney. And Frank asked her, he said, "Do you know that you, the Virginia legislature, has given the associations the authority to fine me and then non-judicially foreclose if I don't pay that fine?" And she says, "No, no, we would never do that." So she turned around to another attorney in the room. She says, "Well, that's not true, is it?" And he says, "Yeah, unfortunately it is. But what's happened is the industry's gone in and incrementally
yes.
lobbied for and got these things. Nobody saw the big picture."
Right.
It's the big picture starting to emerge now.
Right. There's only two places you're going to get anyone to notice the big picture. One is judges in individual lawsuits, and the other is the state legislature on the rare occasions when they revisit the issue at the largest scale. And what I'm saying is, Shu, that judges, when a non-judicial foreclosure case comes out of one of these counties where you can't buy anything else,
mm-hmm.
that judges ought to take judicial notice of that fact, that there is no meaningful choice. And that could be used, in my view, as an argument. This is something I've written in a law review article.
What?
This needs to be viewed as an argument for saying that the contractual term that is oppressive and burdensome is not enforceable. It is not enforceable because it was not really contracted for. If it's an oppressive term that was imposed on a weaker party by a stronger party, and in this case, the stronger party is stronger in part by virtue of the fact there's nothing else you can buy in that area. You're stuck in this form of housing, and this collections technique is allowed. I think that there should be judicial provisions here for saying that these terms are unenforceable in certain conditions. The judges should simply refuse to enforce them.
What can we do? I mean, that's what the judges should do. And unfortunately, I've sat in court and heard judges tell the homeowners to go and work it out with the association's attorney because, and I'm quoting directly here, "I know everyone in his firm and they're all reasonable people. Go work it out with them."
I see that as part of a larger picture here. You know
yeah.
what's going on here? If you look almost... that almost every large county that has a big city in it, all across the country, Cook County here has Chicago and on and on and on, the court systems are just filled to the rooftops with criminal cases. Because of the war on drugs, the crackdown on crime, mandatory sentencing laws, and other things, there's been an enormous increase in the number of criminal cases and criminal defendants. And in 1980, like for example in San Diego where I practiced law, in 1980, about the time I started practicing law, half the court time was spent on criminal cases and half was spent on civil. By 1990, when I left the practice of law and started teaching, it was about more like about 75-25 in favor of criminal. Every death penalty case that goes through an urban court system, you can pretty much say goodbye to a courtroom for a year, because that courtroom is going to do practically nothing else. It'll go to one judge, and that judge normally is going to do nothing else, or virtually nothing else, for a whole year. So, in part, what has happened here is that civil attorneys generally have been forced out of the public court system. They get much less judicial time. And one of the offshoots of that is a sort of privatization of justice.
Right.
And homeowner association cases have become highly privatized. When I was representing homeowner associations in construction defect cases, we hardly ever got to see a real judge. I mean, a public judge.
Mm-hmm.
We got to see retired judges. We pay them $250 an hour, and they'd meet us in the conference room of a bank or in a hotel room or something.
Yeah.
And that's where we did our work, was before these RETA judges.
Yeah.
It's all privatized.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the ordinary person can't afford to engage in this sort of private judicial proceeding. They don't have the money to put up for this sort of thing. So they end up trying to get some little pittance of time from some public judge, and some real judge, in other words, and they can't get it. These cases are viewed as a nuisance. And it's really sad, because there are very important rights and liberties. And obviously, from the standpoint of the owner, their major financial investment is at stake in these cases, and they're viewed as a nuisance. This is really awful, and this is one of the things that I think I would hope an owner's movement can start to bring to the attention of judges and legislators. But it gets back to the same issue. Isolated and alone, the owner is in a very, very bad position. They have got to organize, and that means, this is something I really wanted to mention before we run out of time, that's the state of the homeowners movement. Can we talk about that a little bit?
Yes, please do.
I mean, in the last chapter of my book, I talked about how this was beginning, and I talked about the Maryland Homeowner Association and
mm-hmm.
and some other organizations, and it's grown since then.
Yes.
And now suddenly you see organizations springing up in a whole bunch of states.
Mm-hmm.
George's group, and you've got, so now you've got, you know, Arizona and Texas and obviously Nevada and California and Florida and
yeah.
a whole bunch of other places, in addition to just the few that there were at the beginning. And that's great. But here's the thing, and I don't mean this disparagingly, I'm just saying this realistically, it's still a disjointed rabble.
Mm-hmm.
They're not organized together yet.
Mm-hmm.
And several people have tried, Jean Couturier tried, and other people have tried to get some kind of a national presence.
Mm-hmm.
Because these are becoming national issues.
Yeah,
of course,
they're
state issues, too. There's no question. But look at the industry. The industry is organized at the national level. It has CAI.
Mm-hmm.
And the industry is also organized at the state and local level, CAI chapters, and then other management organizations. Now, the only way you're going to be competitive is if you organize the same way. You have to have a national presence, and you have to have local presence as well. And these issues are, this is hard to do. In fact, CAI has difficulties along those lines.
Mm-hmm.
There are, I think, plenty of CAI local chapters doing things that the national CAI would find horrifying and would like them to stop doing. But they can't always do it, because, I mean, it's not organized like General Motors. And the owners' movement is worse. This is what I keep seeing again and again. Owners get into this because they get interested in this issue because they have a quarrel. They have a problem with their house.
Right.
And that's what they want to talk about.
Right.
When they call me or they send me things, it's always about their quarrel. I've got 30-page single-space letters describing people's wars with their homeowner
mm-hmm.
association. If I
yeah.
read all these things in detail and analyzed them and everything else, I'd never be able to do anything else.
Mm-hmm.
It's unbelievable. And they're horror stories.
And it's the desperation that just really gets to me.
Oh, yes, it's awful. These things are just terrible.
Yeah.
They've tapped people's phones and peered through their windows.
Yeah.
It's taken their property, driven
yeah.
them out of their homes. It's just appalling, some
yeah.
of the things that have happened. But here's the thing. You have to be able to get past your own issue to see the bigger picture. You have to organize over something more significant than just what happened to you. Because once your quarrel is over with, you're gone.
Mm-hmm.
And this is what I think has been happening. And somehow, this is another thing Mansour Olson talked about, by the way. How can you make a group of consumers organize? And there are ways to do it. You need to find a patron. You need to find a sponsor. Someone who will underwrite the organizational costs. That's one thing. And that needs to be done. Somehow, a foundation, a major organization like AARP or Consumer Union, somebody has to underwrite some organizational costs here to try to make a national presence. That's one thing that has to happen. But the second thing that has to happen is people have to be willing to set aside their personal grievances, their demands for being the big honcho, the big dog in the meat locker in their little area, and they have to be willing to let somebody else run the show. And this has been another problem because, you know, in many cases, some of the homeowner advocates around the country, I swear, are their own worst enemy.
Mm-hmm.
Because of the tactics they use, the things they say, they won't trust anybody. They preach that you can't trust anyone except me. You know, not me personally, because
mm-hmm.
you know, I'm on their enemies list too in some cases. But they will say, you know, speaking about themselves, I'm the only person you can trust. Everybody else is a crook.
Mm-hmm.
And this sort of thing. Now, this makes it very hard for any local government or state government official, let alone a national government official, to side with a group that behaves that way.
I know.
They can't take on the cause. They look like nuts.
Yeah, I agree with you.
And that has to stop. You have to present a public image that is consistent with the importance of the cause. You cannot just take positions that are paranoid, that are obviously totally unrealistic, like we're going to, you know, abolish all the existing homeowner associations or something. Just you know, given the way local governments are funded now, you got to offer an alternative.
That's one thing we're not going to get to today. But that was something else I wanted to talk about. Is come up with the real problem is the funding, and
yes.
let's find a solution for the funding. I think that where we've got with associations, and we've talked about some of the problems. You know, we can do away with a lot of that nonsense.
We could, yeah. What there could be kind of a sunset provision here.
Mm-hmm.
And these things should not be set up forever.
Yeah.
What we need is a kind of a sunset provision that these associations are expected to wind down and assume some sort of public form. And this is something Stanley Scott said about, almost, 1964, that when these things were first starting to pop up around the country. He was a public administration scholar at Berkeley. He said, you know, we need to set a time limit on this and at some point have these things turn into something else, something that is subject to public control. And I think some kind of reform along these lines needs to be thought out. Either that or some other framework.
But if that's the problem, that's where we need to be concentrating. And I agree with you in terms of, you know, getting set up nationally to try and do something, and we've got a little bit of a start there, I think. And
I think it's starting. It is starting. The internet has been a huge shot in the arm.
It sure has.
And your show and the show that you and Fred Pilot did, and all the other things that other people have done around the country on the internet and elsewhere, have started things moving. So and it'll never be the same.
Well, I think the thing is education. A lot of people think, gee, I thought it was just me, and it really isn't just
right.
me. It's happening across the country, and I think that's the big picture. And people are, you know, finding out about Privatopia, they're finding out about other books, and they're starting to open their eyes. I mean, they start off with, my board doesn't like me, to, this is a bigger problem. And
right, that's the key issue. You have to start by getting educated.
I
absolutely agree with you. That is the key. You have got to get educated.
Evan, we're out of time. Thank you so much for joining me today. I really appreciate you giving up part of your Saturday to be here with us on the Commons.
Well, it's my pleasure, Sue. We'll have to do it again sometime.
I hope you will come back.
My pleasure, really.
I hope you will.
Well, you have a great show. You're doing a great service for everybody.
Thank you. We'll keep trying. As I told you yesterday, it's a bit like Sesame Street, ABC 123. Over and over again, we'll get it there.
Okay,
everybody, please plan on joining me next Saturday when my guest will be Senator Susan Gerard from Arizona. We'll be talking about the flag issue.